Well, welcome again, listeners, to Food Conversations Season 5. Before we begin, of course, we once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkrepnik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now, back in January of this year, listeners may recall that I had the pleasure of interviewing Giselle Yasmin, the esteemed Canadian policy researcher and former executive director of Food Secure Canada, and now, I might say, associate vice president of the University of Ottawa. What Giselle told me then, most emphatically, was, "You should interview my husband. He's way more interesting than me." Well, I would question her judgment on who is the most interesting, but there's no question that her suggestion was a good one. And today we're going to find out why. We are delighted to have Iskandar Ahmed with us today, the former CEO of Choices Market's grocery store chain, a rather unique cluster of food retail outlets that has become a fixture in the British Columbia food landscape. But Iskandar, who also goes by the name of Nikki, has had a lot more happen in his life than that, and you will learn about it today. Welcome to Food Conversation, Iskandar Nikki Ahmed.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're delighted to have you here. And, you know, perhaps we can start with the story about how you acquired the nickname Nikki, because it's actually quite charming and a very human story. So let me just set the stage a bit. Your great-great-grandfather landed in the coast of Tanzania from Gujarat in western India many years ago, and then moved to Uganda, where he started up what became a very successful retail, I'd call it an empire, that led him to being called by some the uncrowned king of Uganda. Now, that's a pretty grand title, but I think it was well-deserved. Now, a couple of generations later, your father built up an equally successful retail business community, you might say. And one day, you entered into this particular world in a rather interesting way. So go, Nikki.
Well, it's a long story, but I'll try and make it short and sweet. But back in Africa in those days, of course, there was no social net. And my father grew up in the food business. His father had a typical Indian grocery store, what we call a ration store. And if you can picture a small little shop with big sacks of spices and various different things, and he did quite well, and then he expanded and built up a bakery. And my father had his own ideas of how to run a business because he wanted to sell to all the expats that were coming into Uganda. A lot of investment was coming into the country. This is in the 50s.
And there are quite a few of them, communities from
all over the world. And that kind of didn't go so well with my grandfather. So eventually they parted company and my dad went off on his own. And he had no money. He had one child and my mother was expectant, me. And he started a little shop, little probably convenience store size now from in my imagination anyway. And my mom and he were working in the shop, working crazy hours like you see immigrants doing, although they weren't immigrants at the time, of course. Mm-hmm. And when my mom was ready to give birth, she said to my dad, Sadru, his name was Sadru, mm-hmm. I need to get to the hospital now. You know, something, I got to go. And he's like, "Are you crazy? I've got a shop full of customers."
Such a man.
An Asian man in Africa in the 50s in particular. So one of the customers said exactly what you said. "Oh, you men, you're all the same." So she said to my mom, "Nelly, get in my car, but don't give birth. Just wait till we get to the hospital." Right? So she spirits my mom off to the hospital. My mom gets there just in time.
And she said when you got in the car, what did she say? Remember you told me, whatever you do, don't
give birth in my car, right? Because she probably wouldn't know what to do. It's not like today, you know, you can call 911 and they'll walk you through it, right? But they made it to the hospital in time. My mom gave birth to me a few hours later and all was fine. Then every time this lady would come to the shop to the store to do some shopping. Oh, I should just add one thing. It was very typical in those days when you had a store, you lived above. So we call it Niche Dukan Upar Makan. So downstairs the shop, upstairs the house. And my dad had a little apartment. Mom and dad had a little apartment upstairs, and the stairs came right down into the shop. And she would always come to the bottom of the stairs and shout up, and how is little Nikki, right? And the name stuck. And the reason, I don't know why she chose Nikki, but she could not say my real name, given name, which Iskander. Was Iskander, which was kind of a hard, complicated name to say. And so she said Nikki, and then it just stuck and stuck. And to this day, my family still uses Nikki, but all my friends and colleagues and everyone calls me Iskander.
Well, you know, it does confirm that the customer is always right. Maybe it's the ultimate example of that particular maxim. Now, your family was part of the Ismaili Muslim community, and the Ismaili part of the Muslim faith is a particularly progressive part, whose leader, known around the world, is the Aga Khan. Maybe you could share a little bit about the kind of values that you were surrounded by as part of this community, because it's an active community, not a receding community into monastic life and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, we're very fortunate to have this, the Aga Khan as a spiritual leader who's a very enlightened man. And basically when Indians first went to East Africa, they had nothing. And so the Aga Khan taught them to be organized, taught them to be westernized. The previous Aga Khan, who was the current Aga Khan's grandfather, even gave little talks to his followers on how to dress in Western dress, how to make a cup of tea the English way. So he was bringing them, he was teaching them to become more Western, because that was the society in which they were now living, because it was a colony. And because there were no social safety nets there, he got the community to stick together and work together and build their own healthcare clinics and build their own schools. And then over the years, as the community got settled and became prosperous, he made sure that those schools were opened up to not just Ismailis, but to anybody, to the public at large. Mm-hmm. And you can see that largesse continued with the current Aga Khan.
These kind of beneficial social institutions are very much part of the day-to-day life of the Ismaili community. And I was struck by the fact that the current Aga Khan had answered a criticism of the fact that he was encouraging this kind of adaptation by pointing out that as times go by, insights change and understandings of how the world is change, and it's important to adapt to that outer world. And part of the Ismaili tradition is also that it emphasizes the interior, the what some people call the esoteric side of the Muslim faith. In other words, things could be metaphor, not necessarily literal. And of course, in all faiths, there are people who follow them literally, and there are people who see the essence of what's in them. And the Ismaili tradition seems to be very much focused on what's the essence, and the outer cloak can adapt, but the inner essence stays the same.
Oh, you got it bang on, absolutely. In fact, Ismailis, really, the Sufi tradition came out of the Ismaili tradition as well. But before we were Ismailis even, we were Muslims, we were Shias, and then eventually we became Ismailis. The term came because, there was a split and we followed the Imam who was called Ismail. Yes. But the Sufism came out of this tradition.
Yes.
And so we do have that very esoteric side to our spirituality, I guess, if I could put it that way. And so we say there's the exoteric and the esoteric, and you can't neglect one for the other. So, in our tradition, you're not really supposed to go off and sit in a cave and meditate and try and become enlightened. You're supposed to try and do that while you're in the world.
Yes. Well, I think
all these distractions.
That's I think a wonderful pattern to follow, because it is. I think all traditions recognize that service, that doing good things, actually doing good things, not just thinking about it, is a powerful way to better oneself, to gain understanding and enlightenment. And I think that would be part of what we're talking about now. Now, your father started his own retail enterprise after he quit school at age 12, and his father, your grandfather, decided he would punish him, little realizing he was setting him up for the rest of his life. How did that happen to him?
Well, my father was just not interested in school. It just didn't go with him. And he would skip classes, and he started smoking at that age as well. And
oh, my goodness.
Hang out at today you'd call it the 7-Eleven, I guess, right? And eventually he just went to his dad and said, I'm not going to school anymore. I don't like it. It doesn't work for me. I'm just not going to go. And my father had quite a strong character, quite a strong will. And So his grandfather tried and tried and realized that, okay, this is not going to work. So I will, if you're not going to go to school, you have to work in the bakery.
Was that the Diamond Bakery?
That was Diamond Bakery, yes, absolutely. We called it Diamond Bakery. Yeah, good. You did your research.
It's quite famous. It's quite famous, I understand, even now.
Yeah, at the time it was, yes. Yeah, and they, yeah, there's lots of stories there. Anyway, in the bakery, like now, normally as an Indian, when you have heavy labor, like lifting 100-pound sacks of flour and so on, you would employ the locals. So the local Africans would do that kind of heavy lifting, right, and make the bread and so on. And so my grandfather thought, as a punishment, you're going to work with these guys, and you're going to be lifting the bags like they do. And they start at 4 in the morning.
So there's, right? a little tinge, and we'll talk about this more later, a little tinge of kind of mutual sort of racism. The black people are seen as lower, and then Idi Amin, a little while later, went very far in the opposite direction, like everybody that isn't black is persona non grata. But anyway, there's your father organizing in the store.
Yeah. He would get up early, make a cup of tea for his father. So my granddad would get up and then he'd be a cup of tea ready. So my dad knew how to, you know, play the game.
Butter
and then
up.
He'd head off to the bakery and he'd work. And he loved working with those guys and organizing them and becoming friends with them and lifting those pounds of sacks of flour and so on. So, yeah, it set him up to be in the food business, essentially.
Now, he later on opened his own store and he called it Nel Sadri, which was a combination of your mother's nickname. Her real name is Razia, but she has a nickname. Now, was there as good a story behind her nickname as behind yours, or is it just an average, run-of-the-mill nickname?
That's a good question. You know, I've never asked her that. I need to ask her that. Yeah, I think it may be run-of-the-mill, but I'm sure there's a backstory.
Well, the backstory and all that was sort of swept off the stage in 1972. Idi Amin came in 1971 in a military coup, and it didn't take him long to start developing his own narrow thinking processes and impose them on the government. And in 1972, that year, he said that all non-Africans had to leave the country, and most of them were from India, and a very large number of them were Ismaili. That must have been, do you remember the day or the days when that pronouncement came forward? What was that like?
I remember it well because, you know, we had been gone from India for four generations. So we really didn't see ourselves as Indian Indians. We saw ourselves as African Indians, right? We were more Ugandan than we were citizens of India, right, if I can use that term. Yeah. And so it was a real shock that this could happen. That how could you do this to us? Where are we supposed to go? This is our country.
So in this wave of shock that swept through the expatriate community, how did your family respond?
Well, my father was actually out of the country. He had gone with my older sister. They were in Europe. And the announcement was made, I think it was like on a Friday or a Saturday or something. And my dad could not come back. And everybody thought, well, you know what, it'll blow over. He'll change his mind. He's just, you know, he was a crazy guy. And then if not, the international community will come, put pressure on him. But my mom worked for British Airways. At that time, it was called BOAC. And the first thing she did was pack up my younger sister and I, put us on a plane and sent us to London. She's getting out. And people said, you're crazy. It's going to change. And then she called her sister in Kenya, who was in the shipping business, said, I need an empty container. I'm packing up the house. And she shipped out all her furniture, which still has today.
Really?
Right? Yeah. And then she has a very interesting story because then she stayed until the very end and she helped a lot of people escape, people who couldn't afford to leave, who couldn't afford to buy tickets, people who had to hide because the army was looking for them. So that's another segue, but
she was a one woman resistance.
She was, yeah, resistance. Her own way. She became a tough lady. Yeah.
Was your father appropriately grateful for her prescience?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he, first of all, what are you doing? You're crazy sending the kids out and packing up the house. I mean, you know, we're coming back, right?
Yeah.
But she had, I think it was her way of saying, it's time we left Africa. Well, this is our opportunity. Let's just go. know, there's no looking back.
And it's interesting because the Indian community was essentially the economic backbone of Uganda. In fact, Idi Amin knew this, and I think there was some kind of racist rage in his heart. But when he expelled the Asian community, the economy in Uganda collapsed. And it actually went through very tough times, as it turned out, because the valuable role of your family and the community that you were part of was to sustain the country. Now, I noticed, I heard somewhere that your father had helped get passports for people in the Ismaili community to help them get out.
That's an interesting story. So the Ismaili community, as we were saying earlier, is so well organized, very much like the Jewish community. And we had our own council, like a quasi-government.
Right.
And they were separate, like, if you can call them, departments or ministries. And people were appointed, and they did this work as volunteers and helped the community in certain ways, economic development, social welfare, healthcare, and so on, because we had doctors and lawyers and so on, right? So we were trying to lift up the community. And the Aga Khan, the current Aga Khan, he was a young man at the time, had come to visit the community a year before. And my father was the secretary of the council. And he said to my dad, he said, I want you to make sure that every single Ismaili has documentation and a passport, right? Mm-hmm. Within the next year, right? Now, my dad had by this point a successful supermarket, and he had a little wine liquor shop in there. And so he went around the country to all the little villages, helping people get their passports. And he used to bribe the officials with bottles of whiskey and
a time-tested
and people method. Yes, absolutely, it works. I think it works today too, actually. But people who had been living in some of these small towns and villages for 3-4 generations, so they didn't have documentation. There was no such thing as birth certificates. So my dad would say, "Well, do you even have like a bicycle license?" So then he'd go to the local officials and say, here it is, and by the way, this is for you, right? And he got them all documentation, and then they could apply for passports. And he had assistance from his cousin's wife. She acted as his like admin assistant and secretary. And together, the two of them just went around and just made sure everyone was well taken care of.
Now, were you aware of this at the time, or was this something that came out as the years went by? You found out more about this later on. At the time, you were just 13. Yeah, you were 13.
Yeah.
So you go from a nice, warm country with lush vegetation, and you arrive in a cold country with some vegetation, but certainly not the same florid and abundant growth that you would have been used to in Uganda. Everybody I've ever met who came from Uganda, a number of the people that we got to know who came at this time, described it as an incredibly rich ecosystem. Wonderful place to live. So you come from there and you come to Vancouver, and your father can't find work. He can't find work. There were some reasons why people wouldn't hire him on. What kind of things did he hear from potential employers?
Well, what he heard a lot was, you're too old, although he was like barely like 40 at the time. And or you don't have Canadian experience, right? You don't have a degree, you don't have an education, all those kinds of things, right?
Education occurring only, of course, in academic institutions, according to the person who was speaking to him.
That's right, yeah.
He had a ton of education. So
he had, but not a formal one.
So he really, he put his, as they say, nose to the grindstone and really started to scrub around and find out something he could do and start wherever you could start. And he started as cleaning floors.
Yeah, well, we were fortunate because my mom was in the travel business with BOAC in Uganda. So she very quickly got a job as a travel agent. So at least there was something to sustain the family.
Right.
And in the meantime, my dad just kind of became a house husband in a sense and did the shopping and cooking and all that. Actually, I don't think he did much cooking. But, and because he was in the food business, he loved the shopping. And he was in those days, we had Woodward Food Floors in Vancouver. This is I think even Safeway was small, but Woodward's was a predominant place where you went for specialty foods.
Very much so, yes.
And there was this lady doing a demonstration. So he starts chatting with her, and she was demoing some imported foods. So he's talking to her, oh, yeah, I was in this business, and where did this stuff come from, and who imports it? And she says, why don't you go talk to them? right there, you know, it sounds like you know what you're doing, and this is imported food. So he found out the name of the company.
Was that National Importers?
That was National Importers, yeah. And the managing director at the time, the same arguments, you know, no formal education and so on, right? And my dad wouldn't give up. He kept pestering him over the weeks. And eventually the fellow took pity on him and said, okay, I'm fed up of this. I do have a job, but you may not like it. So the job was working in the warehouse, sweeping the floors and basically cleaning the toilets, right? And whatever Joe work they need, you do that. So my dad said, I'll take it. Mm. He was just happy to be working, and he wasn't afraid of hard work or labor. That didn't bother him at all. And at 3 o'clock, the warehouse, they started early, but they finished early. So they finished at 3 o'clock, and all the warehouse guys would go home. And my dad would go upstairs to the offices. And this is way before computers, of course. And everything was paper, and there was tons and tons of paper. And the admin staff, secretaries and so on, could not keep up with the filing. So he would offer to help them, and he would do their filing for them.
Always a good idea to appeal to the basic staff. Don't reach up to the top. They don't know what's going on.
Yeah, and I think it was a way of him just kind of working his way, making friends with everyone, and they realized what a great personality he had. And then they also realized that this guy's actually pretty smart. Right? And so the managing director said, you know, this guy's got some skills. He doesn't give up. He's hardworking. He's not afraid of taking on different things. And yeah, maybe I'll give him a chance. So an opening came up in the office, and he took it.
And the rest, as they say, is history. He ended up being in the head office of the company.
He ended up running the business after a few years because the managing director, the one who gave him the original job, liked him so much, kept promoting him. He eventually became import manager, became this guy's right-hand man. And then he unfortunately got cancer and passed away. And so the owner said, well, you know the business, you take it over, but I want to wind it down in a year.
Well, that's a story of, I wouldn't say rags to riches, but certainly starting at the bottom and working towards the top. Remind listeners that I'm talking today with Iskandar Ahmed, who we also called Nikki, thanks to a family friend in the early years of his life, who most people know as the former CEO of Choices Markets, where he worked for a number of years, and was also a consultant in all sorts of issues related to food retailing. Now, Nikki, when you were, it's not unusual for the child of parents who went through the kind of experience your father went through to say, you've got to get an education. I don't know if that was an injunction that was delivered to you on a silver plate, but somewhere along the line, you did go to school. And the first training you did in the academic world was in biology. It was not sort of in the business world. What was that about, taking a BA and BSc rather in physiology and biochemistry? What was going on in your mind at that time?
I was very interested in studying medicine and becoming a doctor. And, you know, I really wanted to work in international health in developing countries, because having grown up in Africa and seen, you know, the challenges that people face there, I thought, you know, it's an opportunity for me to now give back and do that. And I love studying the body, and I love medicine, and I just thought that would be a really good career for me. So that's why I did the degree in physiology and biochemistry.
And you were also, because there was so much to do with food and the selling of food and the producing of food in your life, you suggested to me that you were starting to make a connection between food and health. Because in biochemistry, of course, you learn probably more than you do in medical school, to tell the truth. You learn something about nutrition and food and food biochemistry. What was percolating in your mind at that time as you were sort of immersed as well in this world of food retailing on the one side in your family, but you were also studying about how biological processes work?
Yeah, I realized, you know, that how important food is, and that there is, was it Hippocrates who said, let thy food be your medicine? And really, if you think about it, you know, we have evolved over hundreds of thousands or millions of years on Earth, incorporating the things that are in the environment around us. And the things that are in the environment around us, yes, there's lots of poisons, but there are lots of things that are healthy and good for us. And that's what sustains our body. And it was really interesting for me in studying biochemistry to see how the body incorporates those things and turns them into you, into this physical being. So if you start putting in things that are kind of man-made and artificial, it just puts a load on the body, and can it handle that? So I was really intrigued by the fact that if we eat well, we really shouldn't need to have medicine.
So you've arrived at this interface between the body and physiological processes and the world of food. What was the process of transitioning into actually moving food around the world, but certainly being directly involved in the buying and selling of food? How did that transition take place?
That came many, many years later, because after I finished my bachelor's degree, the normal course would have been to go straight into med school. But I had an opportunity to work as a volunteer with the Aga Khan Foundation. They were building a hospital. The Aga Khan was building a hospital and medical school in Karachi. And so I decided to go and work as a volunteer for a year and just be involved in that process. And when I was there, I realized that as much as I enjoyed medicine, there's many, many other ways of helping and giving back. So, you know, you can be an administrator, you could be, and also in the international aid community with the big foundations like the Ford Foundations and the Rockefeller Foundations that do a lot of international work, and the Aga Khan Foundation. To get into those organizations, you can do a lot more good than just being a doctor one-on-one.
Sure.
So that kind of made me think about that. But I also realized that if you want to go up in those organizations, you do have to have a more education. You do need further. You need a second degree at least, if not a PhD. So I came back to, after doing my year of volunteering, I came back to Vancouver and came back late in the year. It was too late to apply for anything. Thought, well, you know, I need to continue my education. What am I going to do? And I met a professor of economics, and he convinced me to join him and do a master's degree at UBC.
And there was only one little hiccup in that process.
Well, the hiccup was I'd never taken a course in economics.
A small but significant point, at least in his mind. And eventually you realized it was important.
He said, well, you're a smart guy. You've got an honors degree in sciences. You know, you can do it. And I said, yeah, why not? So, I mean, universities were quite different in those days. I mean, that would probably never happen today. But I got accepted. I got in and I started doing these courses. And after a couple of months, I had to work really hard because I had to go and read these elementary textbooks to understand what was going on in these high-level courses. But after a couple of months, the dean called me in and he said, what are you doing in this program, right? You've never even taken, you know, Economics 101. And he says, I'm really sorry, but I cannot let you continue.
But he was a little more constructive than that, fortunately.
Well, he was very nice. He said, look, you got to take some basic courses. So even though it's late, I'll let you go into the first-year courses because you'll figure it out. Do a year. Prove to me with these basic courses that you got what it takes, and then we'll let you back into the program the next year. You won't have to reapply. You'll just come back in, as long as you get certain grades.
Isn't that one of those wonderful serendipitous circumstances that you couldn't have predicted in advance but came upon you? And yes, it was a good idea. Turned out to be a good idea.
Yeah, and it was kind of, it was a good idea, but at the same time, it was like, why? What am I doing in economics anyway? I just wanted, you know, education here, right?
You were jumping through a hoop, Nikki. You were jumping through a hoop.
And in the meantime, my dad had started his own business in importing. And I don't know if you want the backstory on that, but
that's fantastic.
I decided to join him.
That's
fantastic. Because I figured I'd learn more from him than I would learn in school.
And that was called Ventash.
That was called Gentash. And that was, again, the concatenation of two names, my nieces, Jenna and Natasha.
Well, you've got a good source. You just need to turn to the family when you're looking for a name for something.
Exactly, yeah.
So now you're immersed in the business side of food with this extra knowledge of physiology and biochemistry sort of under your belt. This was 1985, if I recall correctly, when this started up, Gentash.
That's right, yeah.
And things were going well, but they hadn't been going well in the early 80s. That was when this major fall down in the economic progress, if you like, of the world took place in 1980, in the early 1980s. And that's what was the stimulus for your father to start up his own business. And he, there was some indebtedness, but he managed to deal with all of this by just cobbling together his own, and with you and your cousin Salim, starting up this business that actually did extraordinarily well in the long run. He just told, I think you said he told some of the naysayers, you can either fire me or let me go and give me nothing, or you can let me pay the debt off in my own time while I do something that's constructive. It's a very, fairly powerful step that your father took.
Yeah, he was one of those classic entrepreneurs that he makes, he does well, then he loses it all, and then he just bounces right back, and he does that three or four times in his lifetime kind of thing. Right? But what happened was is that when he became managing director of National Importers, the owner had told him, shut it down in a year. But my dad actually turned it around and eventually did so well, they went across the country, right? But the stress of that got to him, and he was making good money, but what he was doing is what his friends were doing, and that was investing in just buying townhouses and things. But his heart was really in the food business. He didn't really pay attention to his investments. And when the bubble burst, those of us who were alive at that time in the early 80s, we saw the bubble burst in Vancouver, which is what scares us about today's situation.
Of course.
Because we've seen it happen. He owed a lot of money to the banks. In the meantime, and because of the stress of that, the bubble bursting, all the hard work they was doing flying across the country, he had a heart attack. So he lost his job and owed all this money to the banks, and he went to them. And in those days, you got to know your bank manager because they stuck around. You had like a bank manager for life kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So they had seen how well he had done. And he said to them, look, I owe you $1 million, which in 84 was a lot of money.
Indeed.
And he said, you've got two choices. You can force me into bankruptcy, in which case you get nothing, or you can work with me, and I promise you I'll pay every penny back, right? And I think the bank managers had a lot more autonomy in those days, and they said, yeah, we know you, we trust you, we can't lend you any money, more money, but we'll let's see where you can go.
But they also had a personal relationship with your father, which is something that is a little hard to come by these days. There's so many impersonal, data-driven, digital relationship that people have with one another. This was a very personal face-to-face relationship he had with his bank manager.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They became like a friend, right? And they really got to know your business really well, and you went out for dinners with them and lunches and stuff, and they were kind of almost part of the family. But that was what they were supposed to do, is really understand the business and understand the psychology of the people running the business as well.
So he and you and your cousin, you put things together, and within a few years, things were really working well to the point where actually the business was sold first to Priceco in from Winnipeg, and then what is now called the Tree of Life Canada, which is a division of Tree of Life, which is an original American company with a different name. So that meant that people in business recognized the success story, and they wanted to be part of it. This was all part of the beginning of the natural foods movement, if you want to call it that. What was it like to be part of that change in attitude that was starting back then?
It was really interesting, and it just kind of happened. I mean, there was a strong natural foods movement, and it was a lot of, you know, the Vietnam Dodgers who came up settling in Nelson and on those little islands, they kind of created the natural foods industry. Sure. in Western Canada. And my dad's cousin, Salim, who was his partner, right, was actually my dad's cousin, not my cousin. He was an accountant and did accounting for a company that looked after all the independent retail stores. There were lots of super values in those days. And so my dad and he were partners, and I joined. And because I was of the new generation, my dad was bringing imported foods. That was his business. That's what he knew. And specialty foods and selling to people like Woodward's Food Floor. But when I looked at it, I said, why does this stuff that we eat, why does it have to have so much junk in it? Like it had MSG and metabisulfites and things you couldn't pronounce. I'm like, why? I would never put that in my body. And so my dad said,
this
well.
This upstart son of his.
Yeah. He says, well, go find the products then. And so I did. And I came across this natural foods industry.
And? And you
and,
said,
you know, I'd go down to these shows in the US that were just small tabletop shows, and the guys would be wearing Birkenstocks in shorts, and they had
ponytails.
And,
yes.
And they really didn't know what they were doing. They were just creating things, and some of them did extremely well, mm-hmm. right, over the years. But the industry was just starting to grow, and they were getting better packaging. And, you know, you mentioned the other day Celestial Seasonings Tea started
indeed.
Off that way.
Moe's,
you know,
23.
Cliff Bar, right? All these big companies
yes.
now, right?
Yes, indeed.
And so we started bringing in products that were healthy just because we wanted to. That's the kind of thing I thought people should be eating. It should be healthy for them. It shouldn't have. Why do you need to have sugar in salad dressings? So sugar's not good for you. So we found salad dressings that were clean and that didn't have sugar in them, for example. Mm. So we were way ahead of the game just because I was of that new generation.
And your father now was obviously listening to you. You know, he maybe his heart attack and the stress he'd been through probably slowed him down a bit. But he was understanding that you could bring some new, fresh insights into the work that he was doing.
Yeah, absolutely. We worked really well together. My father was very outgoing, extrovert, and I was more introverted and didn't like going out. My father went to every event you can imagine. You know, Woody Allen said 80% of success is showing up. Well, he showed up.
He was a 90% guy. Yes.
<He's>, that's right. And so, you know, when I'd find these companies, he would just charm them and they would want to work with him. They said, this is the kind of guy we can do business on a handshake with, right? And so we kind of did well together.
Now, within the Ahmed family, there's a mutual subversion going on. And at one point, your sister took you off to hear John Robbins speak after he'd written the book Diet for a New America. John Robbins, listeners may know, was was supposed to inherit the fortune of the Baskin-Robbins ice cream empire. It was also the taster, he revealed, of the ice cream flavors when they brought a new one in. And he was unhealthy, and he left the Baskin-Robbins empire, went and actually came to British Columbia and on a small farmstead. And that's where he wrote for 7 years, this cool. book. And it's you went to that presentation, and it had an impact on you. It started things off in your mind.
Yeah, it was very, very profound because I was leaning towards becoming vegetarian, partly started off when I was at university and I couldn't afford meat. It was, even in those days, it was expensive. So I ate less and less of it. And I also started to realize because of that spirituality that had been imbued in me is that, you know, why do we need to kill another sentient being for us to survive? In today's world, we've developed that level of consciousness now that we shouldn't have to do that. Plus, living in Canada, you know, there is abundant good nutrition that you can survive by being vegetarian. So I was moving in those directions, but I couldn't quite give up meat. It was just that last step was too hard for me. And then my sister drags me off for, I think it was like Earth Day, the evening before Earth Day or something, to listen to. I'd never heard of this guy before, John Robbins. And I was blown away by what he revealed on the factory farming practices in the US that we all now know about. But he was the first guy who really opened it up. And we looked at it and we said, I cannot participate in that system. That is just awful. I mean, that from a spiritual point of view, from a karmic point of view, this is not good for us physically and soul-wise. Mm-hmm. And from that day, I completely stopped eating meat of any kind. I was vegetarian for 1 month short of 20 years.
It's your anniversary coming up.
Yeah.
I remind listeners that once again I'm speaking with Iskandar Ahmed, who also goes by the name of Nikki, the former CEO of Choices Markets and a widely respected food consultant in the food retail sector. Now, Gentash and its subsequent sort of iterations had a large part of it involved reaching out to small growers, small producers, and involving them in the retail chain. And that led you sort of serendipitously and just naturally into being in the orbit of Choices Markets. You weren't working for them, but you knew them. And in fact, I understand that they were an early customer of Gentash.
Yes, Choices started the first Choices store in 1990. But prior to that, the two brothers who started it, Wayne and Lloyd Lockhart, again, classic entrepreneurs. They had been in the grocery business for their entire working careers. After high school, even during high school, I think they worked at the local Super Value Safeway. Mm. But they worked their way up, and eventually they had their own Super Value down on Broadway and
franchise.
Alma area,
yeah.
And franchise. And then at that time, it was Kelly Douglas who was the head franchisee, which was owned by George Weston, which is Loblaws.
Right.
And they decided to cancel the lease because they wanted to develop the property. So these guys lost the business that they had grown, built up. And they said, you know, this is the opportunity for us to go out and just do our own. Nobody can tell us what to do. And they were one of my early customers at that Super Value.
Mm.
Because they were, you know, grocery store.
It's interesting the word choices. On the choices website, it says, one of the Lockhart brothers said, it's all about providing choice. But you can almost see that their life had been, the choice had been taken away from them with respect to the store that they were operating. And so it was not just, it was something very visceral for them in a certain sense.
It was, and it was a tough time because all of a sudden they're unemployed, they had kids, they had no money. I mean, they need, well, not enough anyway to open your own store, but they found a dilapidated old abandoned store. And it was actually Carol, the older brother Wayne's wife, who said we should call it Choices, because when you were at Super Value, you started bringing in some of these natural foods, and you were always shut down by Kelly Douglas. They didn't like that, but they sold well. So
really?
we should now continue that vein, offer these kinds of foods. But we, you know, they were conventional guys, right, at the beginning, and so they knew they had to have a conventional store. But they now had the ability to give people a choice by offering these other things. And they say, well, let's see where it goes. So let's give them the choice. It was her idea. And of course, they never looked back because they made the right choice. And as natural foods grew, they grew with it.
Absolutely. And you sort of circulated around their wagon train for a while. You weren't necessarily interested in being hired on by Choices. So you played a sort of advisory role with them.
Yeah, so they were obviously one of my good customers when they opened the Choices stores. And then, so 5 years later, my dad decides to retire and sell Gentash. And I went to work for the company that Priceco Foods became Priceco Gentash.
Right.
And I did that for about 3 years. And then eventually they sold to Tree of Life. And then I decided to just leave, go off on my own. And I started doing some consulting work. And the Choices guys approached me and said, hey, look, you know our business. We know you. We know we've got family connections. come and work for us. And we now have the warehouse, because they took over our warehouse, full of foods. And we now, why don't you do for us what you did with your dad?
You know, I've always thought that nagging was an honorable office. It means that one person has a really good idea, but the other person isn't quite ready to hear it. And so they keep on iterating it until the point where the other person says, okay, that is a good idea. Anyway, you moved into the world of the functional world of Choices, and there were some important principles that I think, I mean, I'm sure a lot of listeners know about Choices and they've been in the stores, but the principles behind it were very explicit. There were four or five basic rules that you had. One was that you wanted to have a good experiences both for your customers and for your staff. How was that put into operation? How did that work?
Well, Choices had three pillars, if I can put it that way. And they were care for the community, care for the planet, and care for our people. And by people, they meant the customers as well as their staff. And by community, they meant the greater community. So they gave did a lot of fundraising and gave a lot of money and supported all the local organizations around them, not just the local hockey team or the baseball team, for example, right? It was very purposeful. So they had this kind of mission-driven idea, and that's part of the reason why they were successful, because their customers really appreciated that.
And did that appeal to you also? I mean, with a kind of sense of values shaped by the Ismaili kind of community and the traditions and the Aga Khan's, as you said, getting us all to row in the same direction. I love that phrase.
Yes.
This fitted with you. This was a kind of a universalist perspective that really resonated with you as well, personally.
It certainly did, because, you know, their whole premise is that if we take care of our people, treat them well, train them well, pay them well, they will take care of our customers. And then the whole community, everybody, it's a win-win situation. And I really like that ethos. It really resonated with me, because you don't have to exploit, right, to be successful. And they proved that, right? And, you know, don't kid me, they made money too, and they had to keep opening new stores. But they always made sure that they shared and gave back.
And while you were CEO, the number of stores went from 7 to 11. So obviously, espousing these principles and advancing them on your part as the CEO worked really well in the marketplace as well. One of the things that I was struck by was that you also reached out, because of your background in other parts of the world, Africa and then cultural roots in India, you realize that there's a world outside the confines of this country. And one of the things that Choices did, and you'd already done with Gentash, was to find producers and growers in other parts of the world and bring them on board and have their product lines sold through your stores by having a collaborative relationship with them. You mentioned one in particular, a coconut milk producer in Sri Lanka. Why don't you just give this as an example of how that process worked?
It worked. There was kind of a bit of serendipity there as well, because
my favorite thing, serendipity, in case you're wondering.
when they asked me to join them and help them build up their wholesale business, I said, look, the only way you're going to be successful is if you have products that nobody else has. So not only for your own stores, but if you want to sell to everyone else, because nobody would buy from them. They were trying to do this wholesale and nobody would buy. I said, well, why should they? You're a competitor. So we've got to do what we did at Gentash, find our own lines, create our own private label, and then we can sell them to Choices and we can sell them to everyone else. And so I started looking around and I thought, okay, you know, where's the gap in the market? And I luckily came up with coconut milk. All of the coconut milks that were out there had all these preservatives that we mentioned earlier in them. And I said, there's got to be a clean one. And I found this small family company in Sri Lanka that had a coconut milk that was completely natural. Doesn't even have guar gum, for example.
Good for it. Yeah.
So I said, well, let's see if we can import from them. I said, but first thing we've got to do is we've got to fly out there and meet them. We've got to see the factory because we don't know if there's child labor. We don't know, is it really organic? We've got to check this out for ourselves. And so we went out there and we saw that they had the same values that we did. They had a beautiful, clean factory. They treated their workers well. They were working with small farmers trying to get them certified and transition to that certification. And the farmers were essentially organic anyway, but they didn't have the certification.
Okay. And there was also fair trade certification that you were aiming for as
well. And that fair trade was still, at that time, didn't exist, but it came along later. It actually existed in Europe, but it was coming into the North American sphere, right, and the rest of the world. So all of those kinds of principles, these families like that, they were like Choices. They were already doing that. They already believed in that. Certification doesn't do anything, doesn't change your practices, but it just gives the general public a confidence that you're doing the right thing, right? And so we started working with companies like that and bringing those kinds of products in to Choices.
Talk about the small tin story, the small tin for coconut milk.
So when I was developing the line with this company,
your mother's influence on this subject.
Big influence there. So I got some samples and I said, okay, well, let's just check the quality. Let's just make sure it is the real thing. So I got some samples in, gave them to my mom. I said, Mom, you know, being Indian, you eat a lot of coconut products or curries. So can you test this for me? And the first thing she said is, oh, why does it have to be such a big tin? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she goes, well, it's just your father and me, and I only cook for, and I said, but we eat a lot of curry. I mean, she goes, yeah, but I only use a half a can every time I make a curry, and the rest I put in the fridge, but it only lasts for 3 or 4 days when it was natural, right, in the fridge. So why can't you do a smaller size? So the light went off, and I'm like, why not?
The obedient son matched up with the experienced entrepreneur.
Yes, that's right. So we talked to the company, and the only can they could find was the tomato paste can, the small one. And I said, that'll do. We'll do that. And so we started doing that, and it was kind of an innovation. And it's copied by every company now all over the world.
And I'm pleased to announce that I've only bought coconut milk once because it was in a recipe that I was making, and I bought it in a small tin. I did buy it in a small tin. There's serendipity all over the place. We've got 5 or 10 minutes to go, but I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that, first of all, it's important to mention that in 2017, the Choices chain was bought out by Bylo Foods, which is an arm of Jimmy Pattison's commercial sort of empire, you could call it. Now, a lot of people, including myself, are a bit wary of Jimmy Pattison and the kind of what we see as sort of business practices that are pretty close to the line. But you had direct experience, and you can actually comment on about how there was a gain for the Choices network.
Yeah, it was really good, because what the Pattison Group did for us, it professionalized us, because we were always the classic entrepreneurs. We shoot from the hip. But these guys brought proper business practices, management practices, accounting. Well, we had good accounting practices, but, you know, just that whole new level that professionalized us in a big way. And so those are some of the resources that they were able to bring. And then, of course, the other big resource is money, right? They were able to, if they wanted to, have us build out many, many stores much faster than we could have on our own as independent Choices Markets. So that's what they brought to the table.
But they didn't change the basic ethos of Choices.
No, they didn't want to touch it at all. They left all the management, everybody intact. In fact, that was, I think we were kind of, I mean, if we had said we're not going to stay, they may not have bought the company. I'm just kidding. But no, they wanted us because they wanted to learn from us as well how we do it, because we were so successful.
And they ultimately, and Jimmy Pattison is well recognized as being an astute reader of the market, and he realized that stores like yours, like Choices, were sort of at a cutting edge of where society itself is going. I mean, all business is really dependent on what society chooses to purchase.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, they also recognize that we can teach them things, because Savon was doing a lot of natural foods as well and trying to jump on the trends, but we were always the head. So now they have a partner that we can kind of, it was a kind of a mutual back scratching.
You can pat Jimmy Pattison on the head and say, no, Jimmy, we should do it this way.
Well, that's kind of risky.
I think, yes, indeed. Well, he's got the same kind of head that you and...
when I first met him, he said to me, he said, I didn't buy Choices because I need money. He says, you know, I don't need the money, right? So I didn't buy it to make money. So he says, I want you to look at the long term. I want you to think 15 years to 20 years out. He says, I don't care what you do in the next year. I don't care if you lose money. I want you to look ahead, because I don't need to make any more money, but I want you to think about where the company should be and how you're going to grow it.
Sure.
Right? And I'm thinking, like, this guy was just approaching 90 at that time, and I'm thinking, like, he won't even be around in 15 years. What does he care? But he did. He wanted to make sure that the legacy would continue.
Yes,
and that he was leaving good companies that would do good things.
Well, I think people who are in their 90s, late 80s and 90s, they start to think about legacies. It's an inevitable thing.
I guess so.
But also you can tell the story of your produce manager and his motorbike.
Oh, yeah, that was interesting. So we had this really good director of produce, Dave Wilson, and he really, he didn't have a car. He rode a motorcycle pretty well everywhere. And he would take these vacations in the summer and drive through the Okanagan looking for small farmers. And he made friends with them. And then they would say, hey, there's a guy down the road who's growing garlic. So he'd go visit them and say, well, can you grow garlic? And we were small enough that we could take their entire crop, right? And they could grow with us. And then he would say the next year, if it went well, say, okay, can you plant these different kinds of garlic? So all of a sudden, he created a garlic festival. And Choices was unique in having all these different kinds of garlic. And we were educating the public, like, garlic, it's like wine, you know, there's all kinds of different grapes. Well, there's all kinds of different garlics too. So he would find these little, and he would help these companies grow. And he supported a lot of small farmers in the province of BC.
We're getting pretty close to the end now. I'd like to just talk a little bit about your dad, because he was such a model and well, at his funeral, the obituary says, son, husband, son-in-law, father, grandfather, great-grandfather, cousin, uncle, friend, colleague, entrepreneur, and committed citizen. He must have left a big hole in your life, in the life of your family, when he was gone.
Yeah, he was a larger-than-life character. I mean, he was just an amazing person. Everybody who met him just loved him. To this day, I meet people who say, you know, 30 years ago, I would come and talk to your dad. When I used to get mad at him when we were starting Gentash, and he would talk to people for hours. And I'm saying, what are you doing? We've got work to do. These people, you know, created their businesses. Your dad helped me. And that's 30 years later, people tell me that. It's very heartwarming to hear.
You know, I looked up the etymology of the word entrepreneur, and it's based on two Latin words. One is the word entra, which means to swim out. It's to do with swimming. And prendes, which means to grasp or to understand or to capture. And I must admit, I have this kind of vision of your father almost drowning, but swimming and keeping his head above water and then sort of grasping or even sometimes making a life raft to kind of keep him going. I think his legacy has found a worthy follower in you, my friend. It's been lovely to have you on the show, Nikki. Iskander Ahmed for the world at large. It's been wonderful to have you on the program, and you've really, I think, enlightened a lot of people about not just your own story, but about the story of food in our part of the world and how important that is. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure to be here. I really enjoyed it.